Hello and welcome. The Portavoot Institute for the Study of the Iranian World welcomes you to another episode of our podcast, Legacies of Ancient Persia. Join us as we further explore the many legacies of ancient Persia and its relevance to global patrimony. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Legacies of Ancient Persia. This week, our guest is Dr. Taraj Darye, a professor of Iranian studies and the director of the Dr. Samuel M. Jordan Center for Persian Studies and Culture at the University of California, Irvine. In this episode, we discuss the big Sasanian Empire question that drew him into the field of Iranian studies, who the Sasanians were and what we can thank them for, a look into the Sasanian economy and famous battles, and the resources available now and potentially in the future to aid the study of the Sasanian Empire. We hope you enjoy this episode, and if you like what you hear, please give our show a 5-star rating and review us on Apple or Spotify.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me this morning. I'm pretty excited to get into this conversation, but I would love to start you with what I hope is an easy question, and that's, when did you get into Iranian studies? When did you discover this love for ancient history?
Hello. Yes, thank you, Lexi. I came into the field of Iranian studies and history of pre-modern times rather late. It was maybe the second or third year of undergraduate school at university that I began moving from modern into the past. So it's sometimes professors that pique your interest and make you do these things. And I think I had one of those or two of those.
Well, that's always good. I mean, it's wonderful to have inspirational professors. I definitely had more than one as well who pushed me to explore things. And so once you were introduced to this world, did you find it overwhelming? Like, did you say, oh, there's like so much here, I don't know where to start? Or was it pretty easy to just pick some place, start there, and then?
Yeah. You know, I had begun, my interest was in revolutions in Latin America and comparative with the Middle East. That was what I started. And then I thought, oh, 19th century history, so much more fascinating. And then when I had these professors, I sort of just went back. But my question and my interest was so specific that it did not bother me. And as time goes on, I am realizing how vast this ancient history is. And I think none of us can really master any of it. My specific question was, how did the Sasanian Empire fall? It's something that I should say that probably 90% of the Persians speaking, but Iranians sort of grapple with. But you know, at some time and point in time, you become interested in other things and what larger questions.
Well, that's a great, wonderful question. Also, I love how you picked a question that's broad enough that like you gave yourself a lot of room to operate. I was for a minute there when you said I had a very specific question coming out of a classics program myself, where I had a friend with a very specific question, but hers was like limited to how does this one decoration affect the change of the domestic house? And I was like, okay, that's great. That's just really specific to one thing. So I love that you gave yourself a lot of room. And so were you lucky enough that you had programs that were able to teach you about the Persian Empire? Because a lot of people have to, you know, go through alternative departments to get there.
It was somewhat alternative, but I also had the actually luxury of having professors that, you know, we had 4 semesters of Near Eastern history and then 2 other semesters of ancient Near Eastern history. And so there were a lot of classes that covered not a specific question, but wide expanse of areas and time, which was really good, I think, to give you some perspective. But my question seemed to be just mine and was really important for me. And during my undergraduates, I was just reading to see what has been written and learning to distance myself emotionally to a question that has quite an important significance, I mean, for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating how you know, how much is out there, but also how hard some people have to work to access the resources or the education, and how some people are a bit luckier than others. So it's really across the board in terms of all the people I've ever had the pleasure of speaking with. You know, it's I swear I don't think I ever get the same answer twice. So you had this very specific question, but I want to kind of go back and just ask, what was it about the Sasanians that drew you in, as opposed to, I think, for people who kind of know Persia but don't really know Persia, I think it's more common, right, that people would know the Achaemenids or something and say, let's just do that. So what was it about the Sasanians?
Yeah, I have a two-part answer to this. The first part is, of course, more emotional, just being from Iran and, the political atmosphere after the revolution that, you were thinking, so what happened? How did the Muslims gain victory? What is the consequence? What happens if it hadn't? How did it happen? And so on. I think that was the main issue that I think I came in with. And now I forgot the second part of my answer. I forgot the question in the sense of trying to answer the second part of it. I'm sorry.
No, no worries. I mean, I think it's, yeah, I mean, whether we realize it or not, I think, yeah, a large part of kind of our upbringing, the culture and sort of the influences on us definitely influence what within big fields that we're interested in. So, I mean, the Sasanians were the last of the three big ones, so.
That's the other reason. Now I remember, you take courses here, the Sasanians are mentioned either when you're taking, for example, Byzantine or Roman class, or if you take early Islamic history, it's there in various ways in all of these courses it is mentioned, but it seems to not be studied or taken seriously when I was here in the United States. And so either a class began with them for early Islamic history, or for Roman history was the nemesis of the sort of empire. And that really piqued my interest, that why? Why is the issue that this imperium, this place called Iran Shah, is not studied or understood vis-a-vis these other traditions?
Yeah, so that's true. I mean, the Sasanians, it sounds like they get the same treatment that most of Persia and the Achaemenids get from classics, right? Which is you don't really hear about what's going on in Persia until they come to try to attack Greece, and then you only hear like the invasion of Greece part, and then once they are defeated, they kind of go away and then they stop teaching you about what happens, and they make it sound, at least from the classic side, like it was this big major defeat and they went away and were weakened. And I think it doesn't dawn on a lot of people that the Greek campaigns were just kind of blips on the overall picture of the Achaemenid Empire. But I would guess when you're hearing it from the Greek side, from the little guy, they'll make it sound quite heroic and big, and we've crushed the big man. So the Sasanians, we've covered them a little bit on the show before. We've had people talk about them, but not in any great detail. So I'm wondering, can you tell our audience, let's go deeper. So who are the Sasanians? When did their empire start? When did it roughly end? And why are they so important?
Sure. So as I began to understand this empire and its history, it wasn't really the end that became my interest after all. It became the empire itself during its lifetime from 224 CE to 651 CE, if you want imperial power for the Sasanians. So it was this 4 centuries of an expansive territory that, is not really only Iran. They called their empire Iran Shah, the empire of the Iranians. But it really covered a good bit of what is modern day Iraq, part of the Caucasus, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and so on. And, they come in with a very clear, I think, ideological view. They have a pressing for a specific religious view. And perhaps what is an Iranian? So it's very suddenly, it's interesting. Out of this older empires of the Achaemenids, the Parthians, you suddenly see a cultural shift, I think. I think they want everyone to know that this is different. And I think their neighbors, people living within the empire, also felt that there's something different. And this difference then begins to work culturally. whereby a century before its fall, it has developed an identity for a person living within empire. As if in Rome, who is a Roman? What is a Roman citizen? These very questions then begin to discussed in the Sasanian period. And for at least me, what I've seen the closest ideas with China, comparative studies with China. And in China, also it appears in the 5th and 6th century, the idea of who is Chinese is not so much the ethnicity or the bloodline that one talks, but who partakes into a cultural milieu that is called Chinese. And for this is Iran Shah being Iranian. So it's certain mores, values, legal ideas, and so on. And this allows it to survive as an idea of Iran after its fall. So that cultural component is really important to me. Of course, for the Romanist, it's the Roman and the Persian Wars. For Silk Road studies, is the Silk Road and Persia being the intermediary, but also place of production and control. For different fields of studies, it's important. But the empire itself, of course, for me is central to understanding actually the neighbors. So it's the opposite. And so there are things happening with this empire that are interesting, needs to be known, that makes better sense for the period if we know it.
And who would you say is, I mean, it's so hard to pick one, so maybe I won't pick one, but I think, people are familiar with some of the more famous Achaemenid kings. So who would be the people we should know if we want a quick sort of rundown of who's who in importance during the Sasanian period?
I think the first two kings, Ardashir, the founder of the empire, and his son Shapur, who really established the empire and checked Roman aggression in the Near East and let the Romans know that things have changed. And so they're important. Ideologically, they leave us one of the longest inscriptions, Shapur, explaining who they are, what they stand for. And then I think, there are other important kings such as Narseh in the 4th century, who's also has left us a long inscription, but it's Khosrow the first in the 6th century, and then Khosrow the second in the 7th century, at the end, towards the end of the empire, which bring about not only a cultural efflorescence, but ideas of legality, law, king's law versus religious communities. And then really the reforms and then expansions. These four kings, I think, or five, really stand out.
And out of curiosity, do you have one favorite above all others, or no? Is it too hard to choose?
Well, I'm trying to write a book on the founder, Ardashir Babakan, because I think he comes up with ideas that are not so new in Near Eastern history, but the idea of suddenly calling your empire Iran or Iran Shah. It's curious. Making Zoroastrianism understood as their religion, a sort of militant piety, if I may say so, begins to take shape, which we find in 13th, 14th century in Maghreb, in North Africa. We find it with the Safavids, probably in 16th century. But early on, we're seeing actually a preview to what we find in North Africa and then other places of this militant piety order that comes and takes over and really redefines identity and I think imperium on the Iranian plateau.
That's a lot for one person to do. So it's quite impressive. I'm just, I'm sitting here trying to think what would be, I mean, oh gosh, there's so many basic questions, right? Especially if you're not familiar, not very familiar with this time period and the people. But I'm trying to think, would there be any remaining like monuments or public works or big sort of cultural institutions that were developed then that we still have either in its current form or it's sort of changed? And yeah.
I mean, in terms of monuments, what stands out that, of course, its bare skeleton is halfway there, is its capital and one of the palace called Ctesiphon, which still stands today and close to Baghdad. And that is one of it was a place of pomp, ceremony, prestige. We know what they did inside of it. And it was the highest or tallest standing arch that we have. And we get literary tradition as to what was done into it in terms of, parring with the Byzantines, where, there's the largest carpet there, and the carpets would be changed with season. There were a chair, sort of political chair movement, where, someone who was important or a king was demoted, the chairs were moved. It was a center of course, ritual and politics. But in terms of literature, I think what the Sasanians are mostly known or should be known is for redevising the game of chess, which we know it's Indian in its origin. Chaturanga, it has four limbs, and I think they played with dice. That at least when the Sasanians come, and we have the earliest explanation of this game in Middle Persian from the Sasanian period, it's been changed. And that is something that, of course, still stays with us, as well as the game of backgammon, which they discuss. And this is just not only for game's sake. It becomes part of what we call here paideia. In Persian, we call it farhang, or Middle Persian farhang. To acquire knowledge, you have to know strategy. And to be a good Iranian, to be a citizen of Iran, to know the games of chess and backgammon, to prepare you mentally. So that's the mental aspect, or part of this mental aspect. And then, of course, if I can give you the bodily readiness, is a game that was probably current in Parthia and in China. But it becomes so much synonymous with this Sasanian world is the game of polo. So you play chess to be mentally ready, and you play polo to be bodily ready. And so even today, I think the polo emblem is the emblem of the sports association. So there are these things that continue with us. And for the post Sasanian, one of these kings called Bahram-Ugur, his affairs and movements and wars, and it's so famous, or becomes so famous, that artistically and literary it survives in the Islamic period. And so, in the Timurid period, you have these Shahnames, which shows Bahram hunting and has someone accompanying him. And then you find this even before the Seljuk dishes, and you find obviously on Sasanian silver dishes. And then Nizami Ganjavi puts this historian as the Seven Beauties, sort of one of the most famous medieval Persian texts of Bahram's exploits and his love affairs. So some of these people outlive and continue to live, but he the most, into not only Near Eastern or Middle Eastern literature, both Persian and Arabic, but also some of the things that devise, like chess, backgammon, which the Muslims then take to the other places, as well as polo.
I learned so much because I am an avid chess player, but I really confess I knew nothing about its long and illustrious history other than I just like playing the game. I think it's fun. So, and then I do no, I don't play backgammon, unfortunately, and I don't compete in polo tournaments, but wow. Okay, I have a new appreciation for both of them. Absolutely. So, I think one thing that dawned on me, sort of as we've been speaking, is that you mentioned that you really like the first king who founded the empire, Ardashir. So then I realized, can you tell us why do we call it the Sasanian Empire and not name it after Ardashir?
Sure, absolutely. It's curious that we don't hear from Ardashir, but Sasan seems to have been the progenitor of this dynastic tradition, according to a later epic tradition associated with Ardashir. And then, by the time of Narseh in the late 3rd, early 4th century, then the family, the Sasanagon or the Sasanians, are mentioned in the inscription. So we know that they're from the Sasanian tradition, and then there's an epic tradition of 6th century associating him as the progenitor of these people.
And so I have heard, obviously, I most of the time refer to it as the Sasanian Empire, but I've heard people also call it the Neo-Persian Empire. And I'm wondering, is there a vast difference between calling it one or the other, or are they really just kind of the same?
It depends from which discipline you come and how you see history. So there must have been an older Persian Empire that came in, and so these are new. If you're doing Iranian history, it's just dynastic history of one following another one. I tend to think it is Neo-Persian, but it's in fact more of perhaps the first name-wise Iranian Empire, because they're very fixated on calling themselves that they're the rulers of this realm of the Iranians, Iran Shah. And they want to specify where is Iran Shah. None of the empires before them make this specific reference as to where they're ruling, who they're ruling over, and what religion is the religion that should be sort of the super religion of the empire.
Well, this was all a big attempt to circle back to the original question that you began us with, which is why did the empire eventually fall? So, do you have an answer that you can tell us? What did you discover?
So I think, as time goes by, it's interesting that our notions changes. And I think we'll never find the exact answer or the one that I don't think there's one answer, but I think based on the time period that we're living in, that is the scholars of their time, they tend to pick on a certain aspect or reasoning. And I think now that the variety of disciplines of early Islamic history, conquest literature and textual studies and criticism, we tend to, I think, give several reasons. What's dominant has been dominant that the Persians and the Romans, the Iranians and the Romans fought each other for 20 some odd years, weakening each other, allowing this unified recently Arab forces by their caliphs from the second caliph Omar onwards to be flushed out. Not only to take care of any disruption in local politics, but as conquest force that allows them. I mean, that is the major reasons giving. But internally, of course, we see that the Sasanian Empire is in trouble dynastically at the end of it, where kings are chosen. My idea has been that there were these barracks kings, that is, generals began to choose kings in various parts, sometimes ruling at the same time in the 7th century. So there is a kind of breakup of the prestige of the Sasanian Empire. And even to be more, I think, having made up my mind now, is that one of the important generals of the 7th century, which almost brought down the Byzantine Empire, Shahrbaroz, has an important hand in negotiating with Heraclius, the Roman Byzantine emperor, and not really fighting on any front and keeping his forces in a way to allow the defeat of Khosrow II, where a coup takes place and he's removed. And then from then on, really, you have a period of chaos. And I think the local nobility, the son of the king, and the generals are playing power politics. And that internally, I think, destabilizes the empire.
It's so interesting how when you look at the falls of empires throughout world history, yeah, there never seems to be one overall thing. It's always the mixture of several things that sort of weaken them internally, and then they kind of collapse on themselves. And then, of course, you always get the standard kind of, and then there were coups happening, and then someone decided that this person wasn't doing a good job, and then decided I want to be in charge. So I guess I should have maybe had the expectation that that's probably the answer. I don't know. I thought maybe there might be something else, but yeah, it's fascinating. So one thing that I believe I read somewhere, I can't remember, so you'll have to confirm this or deny it. I think I saw you do have some interest in numismatics or ancient economy. Is that right?
Yes, when I was finishing, I was in graduate school, I received a fellowship to go to the American Numismatic Society. And there you learn the importance of coinage. And then for economic history, for numismatic history, and so on. And my student just recently, Mark Grodoni, came back last summer from the ANS. He had a fellowship who was working on Khosrow's coinage. So this continues in some ways. And it opens up to of course, your eyes. Every time you do a field, a new field, it helps you better understand the whole. And that's, I think, what is important. I am not a numismatist per se to look at variations of dies and so on. But what does that tell us for understanding of the way the empire works, the way economically it operates, and so on. It's part of the jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, having any interest in sort of the basics of numismatics, of course, we can't all be experts in being able to, look at a coin and then point out exactly why it differs from the coin next to it. That's a lot, and you would actually have to be a numismatist. But having this broad sort of understanding of it, though, and having looked at it, I'm curious a little about the Sasanian economy. I think when we think of the ancient world, there's definitely periods where you think of, oh yes, they had money, they had coins, things were made out of gold in some places, silver in others, bronze in others. And but at this time as well, a lot of ancient economies I know were basically run off of farming and agriculture and other things. But as you mentioned, the Sasanians had trade and other relations with places like China, and so I'm assuming that the Silk Road would have come into play. So can you tell us a little bit about how the Sasanian economy kind of worked? Did they use coins and like the trade of goods? Was it
Sure.
mixed? Was it isolated to certain places?
So one thing that, of course, is interesting is that the Sasanians minted both gold and silver, but mainly silver, but also copper in various denominations as well. So there seems to have been the development of an economy that is partly barter, but it seems to be monetary. And what did they enforce that in some ways? And the silver coinage, the drachm of the Sasanians, becomes the recognized silver currency in certain Asia. In some ways, it is the strong currency of the region. And one reason is that it tries to regulate trade from the very first king. To my mind, I just recently wrote an article, Ardashir brings down the caravan cities of Palmyra and Dura and others in order to disrupt the traditional trade from the Near East, these caravan towns and Rome through the Persian Gulf to India and beyond. They want, unlike the Parthians who just collected their taxes from this trade, they want it directly control. And so they established new ports. They are holding the trade. And then we find this very much in the Silk Road Wars in the 5th and the 6th century, where the Byzantines are trying to, of course, learn how to produce silk, but how to get silk from China. They can't because the Persians are blockading them. The Persian merchants are going to East Asia and buying any silk that is available. So the Byzantines can, and then they go to war over it. And not only the Persians with the Sogdians on the Silk Road on land, but also in Southern Arabia, in Yemen, and East Africa. Where it's called the Red Sea Wars, where the Persians, as allies of the Arab Jews, are down there. And of course, the Byzantines are supporting the Christian Aksumites. But beside this sort of religious idea of maybe the two sides, but the reason that they're being supported is that I think the Persians also want to make sure that the Byzantines do not get a foothold on the edge of the Red Sea to be able to control the Red Sea trade.
Okay, wow. That's cool. Okay, I guess I really didn't know much then because I would have assumed by then that the minting of gold would be the primary, I think, source for the money. So, huh.
No, gold was accumulated, so we know but we don't really know. The big question is what happened to the gold? Well, my answer is when the Muslims come, they're going to, use it. But gold was probably kept in the treasury, but silver was the dominant coinage.
Okay, fascinating. Learned something new again. I feel like this is nothing but me learning new things about an empire I was very unfamiliar with. So to continue the trend of fascinating new things I'm learning, you mentioned a couple of battles in there, and that made me realize that I'm not familiar with the, I guess, most famous battles or wars, I guess, that the Sasanians might have fought at any given time during their long history, at least not the way that, certain battles in history are known. So what would you say are one or two of the more important battles that, people should know about?
Yeah, I'm not so much sort of battle knowledge, but of course, when we talk about the Sasanians, everyone focuses on the three battles that the Sasanians lose to the Arab Muslims in the 7th century. But for what is worth, in the third century, Shapur, the second Sasanian ruler in the Near East, is able to capture one Roman emperor, kill another one, and make another one tributary. And of course, they put lots of rock reliefs showing this, and they wrote about it. So that's why we know. And of course, not only that established the power and to show the Romans that they just can't do as they did before, but of course, it's probably one of the rare times in history that someone can do something like this to the Romans, who thought they were invincible, and I think they're checked. So already in the third century, in the battles for the control of the Near East. And, you know, I always put the question in this way to the Romans. It's taken for granted that the Roman Empire, which was in Rome, or then it moved its capital to Byzantium or Constantinople, should be in the Near East. But the question is, you know, the Sasanian capital is in Ctesiphon in Iraq. So who feels more danger and who is being the aggressor here? It obviously, for the Sasanians, whose capital is in Iraq, the Romans being in Iraq, the other side of Euphrates, and then in Syria and in the, you know, in the area there, is much more of a threat. And it needs to be checked, the power of the Romans.
I mean, obviously the Romans are their biggest foe, and just in terms of international reach. I mean, you know, did they have another secondary foe, or did they have pretty good relations with their other neighbors?
They had good relations and not so good relations. What happens is from the late fourth, you begin to have more nomadic and sometimes more powerful nomadic tribes coming from Central Asia to put pressure from the east. These are collectively are known as the Huns, but in fact, we now can identify them beginning with the Alkhans and then the Kidarites and obviously the Hephthalites and the Huns, so the successive group, who are by the 5th century quite powerful and even defeat Sasanian kings and so on. And what the Sasanians have to do to protect themselves, in fact, to build what is now thought to be the longest wall in antiquity. This is, we usually think of the Wall of China, which is not contiguous until later time to stop exactly the same movement of people. But they build it from the east of the Caspian all the way to a distance, quite long, and then also in the Caucasus between the Caspian and the Black Sea. And the wall continues. Eberhard Sauer, with their colleagues, have now published a number of books and two important books showing this long wall and the investment that is needed. So if you could think of, you know, late antiquity and earlier, you could see that for the Romans from Britain and onwards, the wall building to protect people, their empire, for the Sasanians, again, from this incursion, and the Chinese, it is in some sort of unison, not exactly at the same time, to protect themselves from the coming of nomadic tribes. So that seems to be the biggest threat that Sasanians faced, and then the Turks, who were also there. But sometimes they played these people as allies, and sometimes became foes. Sometimes they became the allies of the Romans. Sometimes the Sasanians would extract money from the Romans in the Caucasus for the quote-unquote upkeep and the defense of it. And if the money wasn't paid, the gates would be open, so these nomadic tribes would go towards Rome and create havoc. So there's diplomacy and there's pressure.
Fascinating. I mean, I love international relations, both in the modern stuff and also definitely the ancient stuff, because the ancient world was messy, and it just feels like your enemies one moment and then your friends the next. And then it's very sort of transactional and utilitarian all at once somehow in the ancient world. It's fascinating and I love it. I think one of the things that I'm quite curious about, just because it touches on a lot of the research and stuff that I like to do nowadays. So I'm curious, you know, one, the Sasanian Empire finally fell. Obviously, they didn't all just sort of die out or get killed or leave or whatever. But you may not know this. Are there any dynasties, descendants, like people, I guess, like who would they have been ancestors to now, kind of moving forward in the timeline? Do we have any people who, I guess, could say, like, I'm descended from the Sasanians?
I don't think anyone now can say that. But what we know is that when the last Sasanian king is in power, Yazgir III, sends his children, his daughter and two of his sons, to the east. And so we have a bilingual Chinese Middle Persian inscription of a Sasanian lady. And then we have statue of a Sasanian ruler who's called the commander of the right guard in the Chinese Empire, in the Tang Empire, which seems to have been the grandson. That is the son and grandson of Yazgir, who served in China and were basically the family in exile, attempting to come back and take the throne. And they attempt to do this also to establish themselves in Sistan, which is modern day today, Eastern Iran and Afghanistan, for a while, but they're unsuccessful. And so we think that the major part of the family has moved east, along probably with the nobility who left their lands and so on, and they lived in the east.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know why. I'm always curious of, like, when one dynasty falls, like, where do the people go? What happens? So, okay.
Very good question. No. We have a Japanese scholar who has now passed away. And of course, we know in Japan, I think it's the Nara Museum, I'm not sure, but has important Sasanian objects. And it seems that they moved. And my guess is Korea, China, and Japan all saw Sasanian family in their midst.
Okay. Oh, well, that's cool. I mean, hey, that's fun to know. We've had this now great conversation, and I've learned so much. And I've realized, you know, it's really a shame that I wasn't able to take a class on Sasanian history or any of this. And so for anyone who wants to study and really get into the nitty gritty of Persian history, you know, how can we do better? Like, what is it a resource issue? Is it just like, what in your opinion do you think, what can we do to, like, get this out to more people? Because I find it interesting and I'm sad that it had to come so late. So
first of all, the podcast is really good. And I think this generation, the new generation, also is much more visual and they like to hear or see rather than read per se. It's quite interesting that resources is an issue. It's an empire that its sources are written afterwards, or it's sort of afterward reflection on it. So that's one issue. Secondly is the number of books written on the Sasanian Empire. When I finished school, it was really astounding, 3 or 4 texts having been written. And since I have finished school, I think now several others are written. And so I think we're getting a better sense of it. Still, compared to its Western neighbor, you know, every year you get tens of Roman history, not and so on. But the Sasanians are beginning to become known. And I'm quite glad that this is happening. And of course, that's what we do.
I mean, based on what we've talked about, it seems like the Sasanians would actually make a really great subject for, like, a TV show or a film or something.
Yes.
Do you think, I mean, obviously, neither of us are in Hollywood, but, you know, so maybe what seems obvious to us is not obvious to film executives. But if we were going to, I don't know, just for fun, if we were going to pitch to some movie creator, like, this would be a great topic, a great introductory thing that we could do. Who or what would be a great starting place for a general audience if we were going to introduce them through, like, a film or TV show?
You know, there are these medieval Persian texts, Khosrow Shirin, the story of Khosrow Shirin, which, of course, Nizami also has it, in the way it's a love triangle. I think that would be really interesting. But, you know, anytime I see some of Akira Kurosawa's film, you know, the sensibility, the costumes, in some ways, very much reminds me of the Sasanian world. And so it has that kind of air and sort of epic to it. So it's really interesting. Of course, it needs more audience to know about it. But
well, that's always the struggle, for sure. I mean, and also, like, in terms of not just the general public now, but for students maybe now at a higher level who want to continue and try to study the Sasanians, but any period really of ancient Persian history, you know, Obviously, it's not easy to travel to Iran to go and see things. So, how much do you think that hamstrings students now and future students? And how can we make it easier to sort of make up for the fact that we can't travel there?
I mean, since my own time, it was hard to go, and that brought a disadvantage. If you can't go to the heartland of an empire you're studying, while you can get funding to go to Egypt, to Morocco, to places, it makes it more difficult. Nowadays, of course, in northern Iraq or Iraq has opened up, so people go and they're excavating, or they're going to the southern side of the Persian Gulf, which the Sasanians were present, and in Central Asia. Again, you could, still see the power and sort of remains, and you can go around the countries around it in Armenia, Republic of Azerbaijan, even Georgia. So those places are still, I think, good and viable. And so that's one way of, I think, going over it. And now in the US and Europe, there are many courses on the Sasanians being taught. So that is really, I think things changed.
That's good to hear. Although my impression is that a lot of like the kind of hub or at the center of if you want to go study the Persian Empire is here in Southern California.
Yeah.
I don't know, are there any other sort of hubs in the States that that students can go to, or do they really have to come here?
I think if you want to do history, there are places, we have colleagues who are on the East Coast teaching and can do it and do it quite well. But, I think UCLA is really the center to do this. And then I think UC Irvine just as well, both in California, who specifically teach Sasanian history and then all the things that is related, needed to it, like art history, archaeology, and languages and religions. So you have all these professors, a cluster now that makes it, a bit different, I think, for since a long time, at least in the United States.
Well, I mean, as you mentioned, there are clusters here and there's good work being done both here at UCLA and at UCI. And so I know you mentioned that you're working on a couple of projects and a couple of books. Would you be able to tell our audience like what kind of projects you are working on and if people want to
Sure.
learn more about Sasanian history, but also just Persian history in general, what are the things that you're working on or that are happening that could be resources for them?
So first, if you want to know about Sasanians, we have a web engine here at UC Irvine called Sasanica, Late Antique Iran Project, which sources, texts, images, and so on are there. During COVID, I had the time to write a little book on memory and history. That is how the Sasanians in antiquity saw themselves placed within this ancient Iranian history and how the images changed. So I'm hoping someday to get that out. That was written and it's just collecting dust. And more recently, I've done about four or five articles on Ardeshir, the founder of the Sasanian Empire. And I think those together with a little bit more work can sort of give us an idea of a king that brings major changes religiously, politically, ideologically, not only for its own empire, but its neighbors. So those are my two big projects.
And in terms of things that are also maybe a different format and open to the public, do you have any cool projects you are working on that are in a different medium?
Sure. First of all, this is saying the Sasanica project is open to the public. Everyone can change. And we're discussing a project for, let's say, the study of papyrus, Middle Persian papyrus, which is an important primary source for understanding social, religious, economic history. And that is in the works. We haven't signed it. So once the ink is placed on paper or electronically signed, then I can say more about that.
Nice. And I do know that you are one of the co-organizers, I believe, on a series of upcoming, hopefully, workshops. Can you give the public a little sneak peek about what you hope that these workshops achieve?
Sure. Professor Shaigan and myself are editing the Black Belt Companion to the Sasanian Empire. And of course, he's much more involved in other periods as well. But we have together thought of having a number, and this is a large number, of conferences on various aspects of the Sasanian world, just like the Akwark, the Achaemenid Empire that he's doing with Robert Rohlinger, to have him and I do this beginning at UCLA, Irvine, and then moving around the world and having these publications to rethink and see Sasanian Empire redo, and maybe version 4.0 or 5.0, depending on who's counting.
And obviously, most conference proceedings end up in just a volume. Do you foresee this being open to everyone? Is this mostly for students? Like, yeah, who is going to be able to read the finished product of the conferences, the workshops?
Since these are topical, let's say core and periphery, religion, it is for students who are interested in this period. I think what these conferences and the proceedings do is let us, it allows scholars and people who are writing dissertations and papers to reevaluate the state of the field and how we can reimagine, rewrite, rethink history. And I think that's quite beneficial. Otherwise, you end up with a static history. And Christensen has written a book in 1944 on the Sasanians. So you could use that. But obviously, since 1944, not only discoveries and whatnot has come about, but our understanding of history, our vision of history, our questions have changed drastically, our interest. And I think these proceedings and their publication help us answers.
No, I think that's a really good, great answer that helps illuminate, because I think when I talk to friends outside of the field, I've had a few friends kind of bemoan the fact that, oh, this sounds interesting, but I don't feel like I'd belong. I can't go. I wouldn't understand. And I think it's really important to be able to, tell people like, yeah, I know it sounds very interesting, but you don't feel that, this is quite for you if you're not in the field or an adjacent one. But I think it's important to know that, like, yeah, it's because for a good reason, a lot of this is not designed specifically to be a public conference with sort of easy to understand things, but it does have a purpose, which is if we rethink the state of the field and kind of what should be considered canon for teaching things, that will benefit them in the long run, because then whatever the proceedings yield, you can have people take and convert into something for public use, and it would just be updated. So I think it's really important to have a distinction there. So I would say to anyone who may be listening, whose reaction might have been, "Oh, that's awesome. That doesn't sound like something I then could participate in." It's okay. We will have great info come out, and then someone will take that and make it into something for the public, and you will have access if you want to learn more about the Sasanians, I promise. So there's light.
It's the same thing as any discipline. I mean, be it in the sciences and so on, you have conferences to gain a new understanding and to go further. It just happens that sometimes in the field of humanities, people don't think about the issue, field of humanities the same way, where in fact, it's the same thing. You have these conferences to come up to see how what is new and what has come out, how that will shape our understanding of the world that we live.
Yeah, I think it's really valuable. So thank you for sort of taking the time to explain that, because that's definitely a big misconception. I could ask you so many more questions, but that would take us forever. So I've got to move us along.
Interested in learning more about the wonders of ancient Persia? Visit the UCLA Archaeological Gazetteer of Iran. The Gazetteer digitally preserves famous locations, world heritage sites, and lesser-known areas from all time periods of ancient Iranian history. You can explore using the interactive map or visit the encyclopedic catalog for updates to the ever-growing list of archaeological sites. Visit www.irangazetteer.ucla.edu and learn more about what the Archaeological Gazetteer of Iran has to offer.
There are normally two questions that I like to end with. And the first one is, what, in your opinion, is the greatest legacy left to us from ancient Persia?
So I would frame this, are we talking about us, meaning people living in the West? Are we talking about in the world in the Near East and Iran, but I think because it has different reflections, I think, or afterglows, even if you might say. It is an empire that is very little understood, but it's sort of, for me, it's culture. It's cultural resonance and the idea of Iran. Some of its foundational ideas, even for today, are constructed at that time, whether we like it or not. But I think to understand a civilization, you need deep history. I am very distraught when I see, pundits who have read, international relations, which I like, but having no background to ideas as to connections and deep histories.
Yeah, no, it can definitely be quite upsetting. Also, just considering if you look at Iran in the modern context, especially, I suppose, politically, yeah, people just don't seem to have an appreciation or knowledge since like the revolution. And then they kind of are like that, yep, that starts the history, and now we learn from that. And I'm like, no, I'm like, but it had such a, Iran has such a long, illustrious history. Like, go back to 600 BCE. And they're like, no. So, yeah, I get it. It's frustrating. But yeah, no, the culture, I totally agree with you on that. I mean, it's given us so much and influenced so many other things. So, yeah, totally agree. But the second question I have is, what do you think would be the best legacy that, again, we ourselves can leave for future students of Iranian studies?
Sure. I think what we can do is to, of course, write our books and teach. But to leave the gates open and allow them to write their version of history and also take things to places that we may have never imagined and probably wouldn't imagine, coupled with what now goes on with AI technology, all sorts of things that are going and the amassing of information, which has so much changed. To allow them to sort of move forward and sort of give us the, sustained history 5.0 and 6.0.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer as well. We need more publications, especially when resources are still more scarce than, well, something like Rome, which, as we've said, have how many publications any given month, year? I mean, it's such a fascinating period of history. And I've enjoyed really, really learning so much more about it today in this episode. And I hope that our audience will as well. So I kind of lied. There is one more question, but this is a really easy one. And that is, tell us, where can people find you? Like, how can they get a hold of you if they would like to email you to ask you questions or just check out some of your work, your publications, all this good stuff?
Sure. So I have a website, obviously. Beside my university, I have one. Turajdaria, I think it's GoDaddy. I don't know why this GoDaddy that goes with a .com. But I teach at UC Irvine. I have a UCI email that anyone can find if they Google me. And I try to answer to as many people as possible.
And do you have an academia page?
I do. I do. Turajdaria. I have one that I try to put all of my interviews and publications on it. And that is again available. And not to suggest that I am really important, but everything is there.
Good. Well, I'll make sure to link as many of the things as I can find in our show notes so that way people can send you an email, read your publications, hopefully learn something new, and then maybe perhaps you'll get some emails about perhaps getting some new students.
Sure, I'll send you the links gladly.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join me and just teach me and us, I guess, a little bit more about the Sasanians. I mean, always love these opportunities to learn more about periods of history that I'm unfamiliar with.
It was my pleasure, Lexi. Thank you so much.
Legacies of Ancient Persia is a Portavood podcast production hosted and edited by Lexi Henning, with select episodes co-hosted by Marissa Stevens. Cover art provided by Hadley Leesman and original music by Brent Arhart. Established in 2017 as the premier research center for the study of ancient Iran, the mission of the Pordevut Institute for the Study of the Iranian World is to engage in transformative research on all aspects of Iranian antiquity, including its reception in the medieval and modern periods, by expanding on the traditional domains of old Iranian studies and promoting cross-cultural and interdisciplinary scholarship. Thanks for listening to our show. It's available to stream on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow us on social media at Pordevut Institute and at Pordevut UCLA, or visit our website, pordevut.ucla.edu. If you enjoyed today's episode, please give us a 5-star rating and review us. For podcast inquiries or questions about the Pordevut Institute, please email us at pordevutpodcastproduction@gmail.com. We'll see you next time as we continue our deep dive into the legacies of ancient Persia.